Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions on this fine community radio station. This is KHOI. This is community-supported radio. This is a good place to be. It feels like spring is on its way today, so that's good. That's good. And some other good news. I wish to announce that the video, the Donalana Kitchen Live in Donna's Kitchen, that was recorded for the Practical Farmers of Iowa annual conference, is now on the Donalana Kitchen website.
There's a link to it.
But the whole shebang.
Oh, the whole thing is
Our friend Gil, thanks to him for doing it. It's there with some other videos. This one we actually kind of planned it to be a video. It's good. It's Donna and Lana in Donna's Kitchen talking about how to use those
And it's 45 minutes, and we actually demonstrate how to make liver pate, how to cook a tongue, and also how to make bone stock.
Yes.
So
it's fun. Anyway, it's there. Go to khoifm.org, find the talk section, find the Donna Lana section, and there's a video connection place there too. So check out that website. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we are going to explore the sense of smell, what our nose can tell us. And considering in the kitchen we use our nose a lot, well, this sense of smell has got us all excited. Compared with the sense of smell, our sense of taste is relatively dull, but we need both. We enjoy our remarkable senses of smell and taste to experience different olfactory and gustatory sensations from contact with molecules. It's all about the chemistry, folks. The olfactory receptors in our noses can differentiate among thousands of different odors and contribute to an estimated 80% of flavor. You wouldn't think, but remember, the nose and the mouth are connected. The nose does all of the grabbing things from the air, and the mouth needs moisture, needs liquid to
saliva to
work.
To register, right. Yeah, so there's a lot more registering that goes on in the nose than actually on the tongue.
Right. So we're going to talk about that today. Donna, you had a quote to start us off.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got this book. It's called Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. It's written by Harold McGee, who's also the author of On Food and Cooking. So Harold McGee is probably the most well-known science writer about food and cooking. And the good part of it is that he's actually a very entertaining writer. So this new book, Nosedive, which he spent 10 years writing, let me tell you that it is truly a reference book. It is encyclopedic in its coverage of, he starts with the origin story and the original smells that created the universe. And I mean, there is a lot of chemistry in this book, and more than probably you want or can absorb unless you're, you know, a specialist. So, but he's written it in a way that it is interesting, entertaining, and I keep lopping into it. I still have not read all of it. So that's why we're calling it a reference book. There's so much. He covers, I'm going to show you the table of contents. So he starts out with the simplest smells: among the stars, the planets, the earth, stinking sulfur, life's starter set. Then he goes into animals, dependence, mobility, and microbiomes. And by animals, he's still talking about, you know, the littlest. He starts with the microbes and works right up to through the human animal and like all the smells and things that our bodies create. Then he goes into land plants, independence, mobility, virtuosity. So he talks about families of plant volatiles, green, fruity, flowery, spicy. Then he goes into mosses, trees, grasses, weeds, then a chapter on flowers. Now, I did read the chapter on edible greens and herbs. It's fascinating. We'll quote from that a little bit later. Then he goes into edible roots, seeds, and staples and spices, fruits. Then he gets into land, waters, and afterlife. So he goes into the soil, the fungi, the stone, and then he gets into waters and smells of seaweeds, fish, and then he goes into afterlife, smoke, asphalt, industry. Then the final chapter is chosen smells, where he works with fragrances. That would be more obvious, and that is a fairly well-explored topic. And then cooked foods, which we are slowly reading through because it is so interesting and so dense. And then he has a big chapter on cured and fermented foods. So this is, it's really, really quite a one, and I've been very excited about this. So yesterday we listened to him do a video presentation. So this comes from a group. It's called MAD, which is the Danish word for food, M-A-D. So this is a sort of, oh, it's a kind of a school that's been founded in Denmark by René Redzepi, who is the, so Noma is the restaurant of René Redzepi in Copenhagen. And Noma and René Redzepi have been quite acclaimed for not just their food innovations, but the way they run their business and their outreach and their ecological and environmental footprints. And so the MAD school that he's created, with the support from the Danish government, by the way, is for training food service professionals to kind of think outside of the box, to include all kinds of human and environmental concerns in purveying food and food and cultural concepts in public places. So Lana and I have mentioned his book before, The Noma Guide to Fermentation, which is, I think it's one of the best because part of, I mean, not only does he make really detailed and unique fermented products that he uses a lot in his restaurant, but his way of presentation is so thoughtful. I mean, it has lots of pictures and it leads you step by step through many, many, many things. And one thing that I note when I read about his work is he gets into a lot of complexity of flavor, but it's all using natural biological processes. And he can come up with all kinds of flavors like garums and, you know, unbelievable, complicated, some of them quite ancient, that it, on your taste buds, they do similar things that some of these newer kind of laboratory foods are trying to replicate. But he's doing it all without any kind of genetic it is still molecular manipulation, but it occurs in nature.
It is all chemistry, but there's a lot of chemistry that we just want to celebrate and get into. And that's what this Harold McGee guy talked about, David. Well, he was really fun.
Oh, yeah. He talked about a half an hour, and then there were questions and answers because there's this, it's called Mad Mondays. So they, and there's not too many of them. I will watch if there's more and they're interesting. But this one really caught my attention because it is all about the sense of smell, which is, it's very important to all of us for many reasons, not just for cooking. It's, you know, like if you can't, people who have a lost sense of smell, for example, they are at danger of not being able to smell smoke if their house is on fire. For example, your sense of smell is, it's as important as seeing. We just kind of forget about it.
Forget about it.
So this book, in writing this book, Harold McGee is really encouraging all of us to become more aware of our sense of smell, because we can train ourselves to be more aware of the complexities of smell. And we'll get into that in a bit later. So he has this wonderful quote in the beginning of the book. And the quote is from Jean-Paul Sartre. So The smell of a person's body is the body itself, which we breathe in through our nose and mouth, which we suddenly possess as though it were the body's most secret substance and, in short, its nature. The smell, which is in me, is the fusion of the other person's body with my body, but it's the other's body and the flesh removed, a vaporized body, which has remained completely itself, but which has become a volatile spirit. So he's using this quote in the introduction because he's reminding us that the sense of smell, you know, you have the receptors in your body, but what you are responding to are molecules, real volatilized molecules of other substances that you are taking into your body through your breath and through your mouth as well. Mm-hmm. But that's what the sense of smell is. And so the whole book is about how compounds volatilize and how the volatilization is changed through weather, through cooking, through, you know, and how the volatilization process and these effects break things down into different compounds. So he's got,
I thought what was interesting, he started out sort of coining a new word. He talks about the osmocosm, which is smell and world or cosmos, smell world put together. So he refers off to the osmocosm, reminding us that it's not just in things that we eat, it's everything. Everything. It depends on
good smells and the bad smells.
Yeah. And he said, it's kind of like the night sky. I mean, look at all the stars up there. We may hone in on one or two of them, but they're all there all the time. And it's really our brain and our nose working together and kind of learning how all this stuff
works. And talking about the brain. So, you know, when he's talking about, can you train yourself to and your sense of smell, that was one of the questions. And he says, yes, you train it with your attention to the smells. And he says, so what happens is you get an experience of a smell or an odor, and that goes into your memory banks, and you process it, and you are building neural pathways every time you do it. So if you're exercising it, it's simply the same as exercising any other function. You will build up that part of your brain that registers those. Mm-hmm. And like in a Proustian sense, the memory is very, very important. It holds what association you have with that smell. Like he talked about, he had this really funny example of there's a certain kind of ant in the Amazon, an Amazonian ant, which tastes to us like ginger or lemongrass. Okay. So that's how we would describe it, because we have tasted in the Western world, we have mostly all tasted ginger, mostly have all tasted lemongrass. So when we are exposed to a new thing like these ants, that tastes like ginger and lemongrass. So when for his book, he actually went to the place in the Amazon where they are familiar with eating these ants, and he took some ginger to them and some lemongrass, which they had never tasted. And when they tasted, they go, oh, that tastes just like those ants. Yeah. So our ability to name these flavors and put them in our memory banks with associations is very culturally induced, because the language around smells is culturally induced.
And very personal, too.
And very,
I mean, if you've had an aunt or two, maybe you'd have your opinion, too. But
And how often do we talk, especially in literature, how a certain smell will be evocative of something that was maybe redolent in our childhood, like a particular cake or a cookie, or, you know, that's why Proust writes about the Marjolaine cookies of his childhood. And when he smells them, he's transported back to that childhood moment, usually one of comfort, but not always. There probably are many smells that are associated in the memory banks with alarm and unpleasant. In fact, that's probably how we toilet train children, I suppose.
Ooh,
something to do with that, you know. Okay, that smell goes in the bathroom, and that smell goes in the kitchen, and we are quite
we learn
organized around smells. So
we're starting to think about the smell of spring. Is there such a thing as a smell of spring? And Harold McGee said, well, of course, things volatilize. And as the snow melts, especially in these latitudes.
Right, because heat causes volatilization. So when the world is frozen, the volatile molecules and the smells are quite reduced. And when the sun shines and the spring comes back, they're gradually released in the first in the melting snow, which is where the stage we're in. And then when the soil is barren, it begins to thaw out. You start to smell the soil odors. Mm-hmm. And boy, by that time, we are all really happy to smell those smells of spring.
Which kind of leads us to the smell of laundry on a line out there in the sunshine, picking up the odors of the outside as opposed to tumbling around in a dryer. And then also remember that a lot of companies spend a lot of money
covering up flavors.
Yeah, trying to convince us that the smell of laundry, dirty laundry, human bodies is not good. So you should have deodorants and fragrances to cover it. And, well, we just kind of have lost our way.
Yeah, Harold McGee calls this, and yesterday he referred to it as the deodorized society. And he did, when people were asking about can you cultivate your sense of smell, one of the suggestions that he said was to stop using things like fragrance dryer sheets and aerosol sprays around the house and scented candles, and to kind of get rid of those artificial scents that are covering other smells, to encourage you to expand your smell awareness. And he and the book is very clear about this. We have to realize that what we are smelling are actual molecular structures. They are a reality.
It's not magic.
No, it's not magic. And we just can't see it.
Yeah.
But it definitely is a chemical hardcore reality that we experience. So he encouraged, to get rid of a lot of those masking chemicals so that we can better smell the reality in which we're living in, and that yeah. gives us a wider range of smells.
And also, think of smell. I mean, you're not just smelling one thing. Everything gives off multiple molecules. And he talks about it as a chord, as a musical chord of smells. The individual notes are there, but most things are chords of smells. And one of the examples he gave was the smell of curry powder. That's not just one thing.
Right. Curry is a spice mix. And it's a very good and obvious example that explains that. And different curries are different spice right. mixes. So, when you're tasting a curry, sometimes you want to tease it out. Okay, cumin is often a dominant note. Turmeric is often dominant because it has this kind of flat metallic flavor. And the color is so obvious, that golden color. But there are many, many other spices and do go into a curry.
Another one is fenugreek. I have no yes. idea what fenugreek is. I figured it was like a Scandinavian Greek person. I don't know, like Finnish.
Oh, it's a little seed that itself has oh, like I think Gio made some Georgian beans one time that had fenugreek. We'll have to cook with that, Lonnie. Fenugreek. You're going to really like that.
Fenugreek.
It's you can get it. It's widely available because you make a fenugreek tea is very common.
Oh,
in fact, I can remember when my oldest daughter was a baby and had a really, really runny nose, I would make a fenugreek tea and feed her that in a bottle, because fenugreek kind of helps dry up. Like if you have a cold, it dries up some of the mucosal secretions in your nose.
See, another nose thing.
So there's my association with fenugreek. I think about the tea that I fed the baby.
Ha!
Because it's mild. So
I'll have to go smell some of that.
Yeah,
yes,
we'll have to get you some.
All sorts of things, sorts of things. So that's curry powder. So we look for a full chord, not just smell. And we can train ourselves and enjoy it as we do it, too.
Well, and one of the reasons for maybe not using the highly fragranced Well, laundry detergents is a big place, because then all your clothes smell like that and your house smells like that. And like, I used to notice I'd be riding my bicycle around the neighborhood and you'd come into a patch where it would all smell like laundry detergent. You realize this is coming out of somebody's dryer vent. And it's like, oh, phooey. Here I was driving through the lindenflower smell, you know, in early summer. And all of a sudden, there's that note of laundry detergent. Yuck. But we do that a lot.
That's the idea of not appreciating smells. We're kind of getting to the stage where our clothes smell a little bit like body odor, or our sheets smell a little bit. That's not so good. So we have to quick wash them. And
it's not so good. For example, when you have children, babies smell a certain way, and it's really, really lovely. But also, as your children get older, I still can kind of remember the fragrance, for example, of the pillow that my son used to sleep on, you know, and it's a definite body odor, but it's a beautiful body odor to me still. You know, we feel like we have to cover or suppress all of these odors when really, there's nothing wrong with them, and everyone has a unique smell. And of course, that changes depending on their health, on their what they've eaten, of course. In fact, not in modern medicine, but in ancient medicine, the smell, the doctors and healers were trained to, because this was one of the only things they had, to diagnose from the smell of the person.
Oh, yes.
Either from their breath or the way their body smelled, it does indicate in certain either health problems or, you know, it's a very remarkable and sensitive diagnostic tool.
Well, of course, our dogs and cats and our other animals too, they use their noses first. They probably learn a lot from us, a lot about us just from smelling. That's good. Any other good stuff in this book? Ha.
Oh, a lot of things. You know, one more thing about the deodorized society and having all of these not natural fragrances covering. The not natural fragrances can be so dominating and loud, you know, that you miss the smaller. I mean, and sometimes that's the point of it, right? But you lose the ability to find the finer notes and the smaller things. Now, I particularly appreciate my sense of smell, because it's something in cooking I've really, really worked to develop. Like I can not always, but often sit down and, like at a restaurant, and somebody will say, "Taste this, Donna," and I'll try it. And then we can go home and do it ourselves from the way it tastes and looks, and particularly from the way it smells. You can recreate the recipe that way, because I've learned to know, okay, that is because such and such is in it. And chefs often, you know, it's a very show-offy thing. Oh, I can detect. Well, same thing with sommeliers, right? I can detect this flavor and that flavor. So it is something that I have worked to develop, and I enjoy a lot.
Yeah, pretty much. Oh, and another thing that was discussed in this Zoom session that we're on, in this lecture that we're part of, one of the participants talked about, I've been having a little trouble with my relationship with my significant other, and I found out that he changed his deodorant. And she said, it wasn't like, you know, a bad thing. It was just like she was having second thoughts.
She found him less attractive because he had changed his deodorant, and she couldn't put her finger on why she was feeling that way. And finally she said to him, did you make some sort of change? And he said, yeah, I went to buy the kind of deodorant that I always wear, and it wasn't available, so I bought another one. And she admitted that practically had ruined the relationship, and she was really glad that she had discovered what the problem was.
We learn a lot from our noses. The nose kind of, no, actually, it's been part of us that it's a skill and it's a survival skill. Ha! We will come back and talk a lot more about the sense of smells, particularly the sense of smell in the kitchen. We've got lots to say about how things smell and how we use them in the kitchen. We know that the nose knows. Yes, we do. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We are talking about what our nose knows today, the sense of smell. I've been talking about a really good book by an author called Harold McGee, and I'm going to get to talk about food in the kitchen, the sense of smell, especially with some of the herbs that we have. Donna, have at it.
So his chapter on edible greens and herbs was a particularly fun read, and he starts out with the basic mint family, which includes basils, and also he's got in here. Well, he starts out by talking about why these herbs are particularly strongly flavored, and that a lot of them, like marjoram, rosemary, lavender, and other mint family things, or how would you pronounce this? Nepetalia?
Never heard of it.
Oh. It's the mint families, how they have a rather aggressive quality of flavor. And he talks about how, because it's a protection, because they grow in very rocky, dry climates, or at least they originated in those climates where if they didn't have a strong flavor, they would have a lot of predators because there's just not that much for like foraging animals to eat and stuff. So these things have really strong flavors so that, you know, the smaller animals are not going to eat them because it's too much. Whereas we humans, when we cultivate them, we can have for our size a tiny percentage. And then that strong flavor is, you know, diluted because it's used just as a cooking ingredient.
That's true. If you would take a whole handful of rosemary and try to chomp it down, it would kind of overpower. It would overpower. And so we've learned to use a pinch of this and a pinch of that.
Yeah, he mentions things like that I grow in my garden with anise hyssop and shiso and of course basils. And then he says, This is helpful as a cook. Where's the basil thing? No, that's the cilantro. A different line of research has confirmed that the volatile composition of basil changes as individual leaves and whole plants grow and mature. Young leaves have a higher proportion of scent glands to green tissue and more volatiles in those glands. They gradually lose the volatiles to evaporation. Moreover, leaves on young plants synthesize their volatiles in different proportion from those of the new leaves on mature plants. Standard Italian practice for pesto is to harvest the whole Genovese basil plant while they're still quite young after just a few weeks growth with only three sets of leaves. Obviously that, I mean, and Lana and I have noticed, as many other gardeners do, that the first basils of summer are much more enchanting than the later, you know, even if you keep cutting it back, you will still get less burst of flavor than you do initially. Mm-hmm. And there's a biological reason for that. I mean, I used to think, oh, it's just that, you know, we're so excited by the newness of the season and then later on, but no, it is actually a physiological effect. He mentions lovage, another favorite herb of Lana and I. And,
another very much a in your nose. It smells.
Celery family, right?
Celery.
And he says it's someplace in here. It was called the plant. It was compared to. I forgot, Lana. I can't find it. Where did it go? Sorry, guys. Maggi, the Maggi plant. Some places it's called the Maggi plant. So Maggi is like a concentrated flavor extract that people use. I think it's vegetarian, but he was just saying because the Maggi itself has some of the same volatile compounds when it breaks down as lovage. And this is one reason that Lana and I have encouraged everyone to grow lovage, because you can't buy it, because it is such a good flavoring ingredient in stews, in salads, and in a lot of other places. And of course, he breaks it down into, it has the component smells, floral, celery, pine, grassy, and then the names for the molecules. This is the very chemical part. Terpenyl acetate, ligustilide, benzofluorescence, and philandrine.
Well, put that in your pipe.
Okay,
and
there's
smoke
a lot,
it, yeah.
And he puts in the whole book all this in the chemical stuff in little tables, so it's there and you can deal with it or not, because it gets really
One thing I would like to talk about is cilantro.
Huh.
The smell of cilantro. Now, some people cannot stand the smell or taste of cilantro, and when cilantro is not something I grew up with in dairy country up in the middle of Wisconsin. No siree. Cilantro was not something I think I ran into until I was an adult. And when I first tasted cilantro, I had a taste and
yuck
a
moment,
a memory. And it reminds me of third grade. This tastes like school paste. This tastes like the mimeograph machine, and it tastes like the wax floors in my old school building. Why did those flavors and why did that scent come back to me? And here we go in this book.
Here's what Harold McGee says. Okay, so he, with the cilantro, he calls it soapy, musty, waxy, green, and pungent. And then I'm going to read directly from the text. It says, cilantro and culantro are very popular in much of the world today, notably Southern Asia and Mexico, but they're despised by significant and vocal numbers elsewhere. The early English botanist Jeremiah Grew wrote that coriander leaves, quote, stink so basely they can hardly be endured, and modern haters often describe the flavor as soapy. This difference in taste is likely due to genetic differences in sensitivity to the volatiles, cultural differences in exposure to them, and also to their unusual nature. They are neither terpenoids nor benzoids, the usual herb volatiles, so they don't immediately suggest aromatic plants. Instead, these aldehydes are commonly encountered in everyday life as breakdown fragments in the long chain lipids in soaps and cosmetics, materials that are inedible and distasteful. They're also emitted by various insects, including stink bugs.
Well,
no
one
can take some getting used to. Fortunately for people who dislike cilantro, and unfortunately for those who like it, aldehydes are intrinsically reactive molecules, so they disappear soon after they're released by pounding or cooking.
There you go.
So when you cook, the thing with cilantro is it's usually added
after,
at the end, so you can still taste it, mm-hmm, or something, for those of us that like it,
yeah,
right? So
yeah,
there you have cilantro. Now, there is one other little fascinating thing that Lonnie and I are going to try this summer.
Oh, this is good.
So yes. He's talking about, the tomato leaf.
Yeah, the leaf, not the tomato, the leaf of the plant.
Right. And he also gets into how different leaves store those volatile molecules in different places and why lots of them have sort of hairy surfaces and things like that. So once more from the text, here we go. Another distinctive aromatic native to Latin America is the tomato vine, whose hairy foliage hairy foliage leaves a strong smell on the skin or clothes that brush against it. Tomato fruits are beloved the world around, but the leaves have long been thought to contain toxic alkaloids. Recent research has shown that their alkaloids are not only not toxic, but they may even be beneficial. The volatile rich leaves offer another variation on the green and terpenoid themes, with a chemical medicinal mix of turpentine, camphor, and eucalyptus notes, and a touch of the clove benzenoid eugenol. They can contribute another dimension when added at the last minute to sauces made from tomato fruit. Now, Lon and I are going to put that to the test as soon as we've got tomatoes and tomato leaves.
This guy says they're not toxic. That's good.
I believe Harold McGee. He is thorough researcher.
In my long ago, and I've been doing this, tomato leaves and potato leaves that were related, they both kind of smell. They had that strong smell.
I'll read the potato part. Maybe he talks about potato leaves.
Oh, okay. Leaves, yeah.
We'll see.
But they're different.
Eat sweet potato leaves. Yeah. They make a lovely green.
Different thing. Okay. But there's that smell that comes off of them. And I've heard them suggested as a insect repellent, that kind of smell. So they have a smell, and that comes off the tomato leaves.
They don't repel those. What are those funny worms that eat tomato leaves like crazy?
Oh, no, they must like those.
The
dreaded tomato hornworm?
Yes.
Those
are such characters. I guess they know what they're doing, those tomato hornworms.
There's no accounting for taste, I tell you. That's good. That's a good thing.
So there is a lot. We will be using this book for other little stories that we'll be bringing to you. If you're supremely curious about these things, I would recommend buying a copy of this to browse into. It is not something that you're going to sit down and read through.
Well, it may be the kind of thing you read late at night and fall asleep to, huh?
Well, it's,
of course, you do get excited by all this and go into the kitchen.
There's so much information that you just have to kind of take it a little bit at a time. Like we Lon and I are talking today, we think we'll do our next show is, you know, kind of beginning to be hopeful about starting gardening, and we might talk about composting or something. So I will read the chapter that he has on soil and soil microbes, and
that
we'll probably
all smells
be
that
quoting
all,
at you
it
from
all
this
smells
book again.
It all smells. And also, kind of keeping things up with the news, one of the things that some of the sufferers of the COVID virus have noticed, they lose their sense of smell. And actually, not just with that, sometimes if you have a bad cold, that happens too. It's a bad thing to lose. Yes, it is a bad thing to lose. This is KHOI, and you're listening to the Donalana Kitchen. If you want to find out more about the Donalana Kitchen, go to khoyfm.org. Find out more about us and find out more about this fine radio station. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking about the sense of smell today. There's a lot of different compounds that float around. We are surrounded by molecules, and we have this thing on the front of our face that we use to get along in the world, and it inhales those things and keeps little stores of information in our brain. The sense of smell is an amazing thing. Like we said before, without the sense of smell, the sense of taste is really not too good, because the sense of smell is really busy dealing with all the
right, in
molecules.
Terms of information gathering, mm-hmm. The sense of smell is far vaster than the sense of taste. Well, for good reason, because for taste, the actual whatever you're trying to synthesize has to land on your tongue, whereas with the sense of smell, all of these volatile compounds that are surrounding us everywhere that we don't see or feel, they can hit the receptors. So it's the sense of smell gathers things from much further afield than the sense of taste. And in our body construction wisdom, we have a lot more receptors for the sense of smell than we do for the sense of taste. So yesterday, when we were listening to Harold McGee, the author of Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells, on the conference call, because they were mostly restaurant and food service and other professionals, there were a lot of sommeliers, right?
I was going to write that in my list of things to talk about, but I couldn't figure out how to spell it. These specialists in wine.
A sommelier is the person in the restaurant who picks and chooses the wines. And of course, to have a sommelier certificate, you actually have to have a fairly formal education and learn to identify on your tongue, you know, various flavors. So you in essence are really training not just your taste buds, but also your sense of smell. Like, for example, when you are sampling a wine or a whiskey or a lot of other things, you stick your nose into it first. Like if you're sampling a wine or a whiskey, you smell it first before you taste it.
That's not an affectation. Really, we do drink much alcohol with our nose first.
Mm-hmm. And because alcohol volatilizes fairly easily. And one of the things that he was saying yesterday, Harold McGee was saying, that I think some of the sommeliers were hoping that there would be some kind of really scientific breakdown on some of these smells. And he kind of said, yeah, it's not quite that simple. You know, we're just not there. But he did say, I thought this was interesting, that for grain alcohols like scotch and things like that, they're so heavy that a little bit of water added to them causes more volatilization, so you can actually taste and smell them more perfectly, which is why if you have a really good scotch, some people will drop an ice cube in it, but it's also just well known to put a splash of water in it. Because if you put the ice in, the coldness of the ice will make it less volatile, so maybe you don't want to chill it. Whereas if you put just a splash of water into it, the water, how did he say that? It lightens the mixture of the volatiles and they become more present.
Right.
So there's a reason for it.
They evaporate more with water. They just kind of stay in the
glass.
He talked about some alcohols actually being kind of a thick, there's a texture, a viscosity to it.
Yeah.
And if you want to enjoy the smell, that's why they add water to scotch.
Right. Like even with your wine glass, how you swirl it and smell it, that's because it's stirring up the volatiles so you can smell it better. Or even, and the viscosity, like this is, I always thought this was funny. When you swirl the wine in the glass, then as you hold it upright again, it has what are called legs, which it means the way the wine drips down on the inside of the glass. So some wines have more of that than others because they have a sort of a thicker viscosity, mm-hmm. Which I suppose in terms of smell would mean that it would take a little bit more to volatilize that one.
So one thing that's amazing is somehow we have to categorize what we smell, and probably
so maybe, we can talk about it, right?
Maybe in
other
in,
than just go, gee, that tastes good.
That's good.
Right?
Yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10.
I like this. I don't like that. Right?
Well, in perfume, I'm sure they had that. But wine, people almost make fun of the fact that you can call a wine anything. There are certain words that.
Oh,
that
yeah. Like he used, like, oh, this wine tastes like old saddle leather.
Oh, that just sounds like that. Give me a glass of that stuff. Yeah. But no, but the fact that people can taste, and really some of these tastes are, oh, yes, I smell that too. And it's amazing. They're not tasting a saddle, they are tasting a wine. Because, again, it's not really just happening in our nose. And it's a very personal thing. It's how we categorize it in our brain. Smells are complicated things.
Well, and especially, you know, it can be very pretentious, you know. So I think Harold McGee was kind of like holding back and making fun of a little of that. Although he, of course, can validate it because his whole book is about how smell is associative and the language around it is associative. You know, maybe if you rode horses a lot and smelled a lot of old saddles, that would be an adequate description for you of a certain wine thing when you later encountered it. However, one would assume that most people who are using it as a descriptor in wine tasting have, in fact, not really ever ridden old saddles.
Or smelled an old saddle.
Yeah, exactly. That may be true for some people, but that does lead to the pretentiousness of language around it. And, of course, since wines can run from, the very mundane pricing to the very, very expensive, that whole field is loaded with the possibility of, let's say, hubris, perhaps.
Perhaps. The idea of, it used to be, before the invention of all these plastic corks that we have in wine bottles now, there were cork corks made out of tree bark, cork corks, and the idea of smelling the cork was supposed to show that you really knew something.
Well, but there was a reason.
Yeah.
Well, there are two reasons for it. First of all, the cork, since it's a natural tree product, would absorb some of the chemicals and the volatiles from the bottle itself. And if a wine had been stored for a long time, the cork was probably fairly saturated to some senses. The other reason for smelling the cork was if a bottle, perhaps in long storage, had not been properly corked, you can smell it on the cork, and sometimes the cork disintegrates into the bottle, which is not always you don't want to drink the cork, so you have to filter it, but it does not always indicate that the wine is spoiled. So if you smell the cork and you know what that smell is that is not desired in the final product, you can basically tell the sommelier to take that wine back because the cork, it's as they call it, it's corked. The wine was not properly preserved in the bottle, and you can tell by smelling the cork.
Ha.
But you have to be pretty experienced to know what that
is. But the idea of good smell, bad smell. Even if we think we don't have much of a nose for things, we know when meat has gone off, eh? We know that.
Oh, yeah. And especially I use it a lot for, well, certainly for animal products, particularly for milk. Like, sometimes you got a bottle of milk in the fridge and you're looking at the sell-by date, which is an indicator, but not completely, because it will depend on the temperature that the milk was stored at. Was it left out on the counter for an hour? That will make it go bad more quickly. And you can't know that except by smelling. Mm-hmm. And when milk is off, you can smell it right away.
Yeah, I don't know how it is in a lot of Iowa households, but I get stuff put under my nose all the time. Hair, has this gone bad? Smell this. And well, I think, okay, give it a try. Because I really do have a pretty good sense of smell. I can tell. And
Especially with me, it's important. I can tell right away. I also have a saying to myself, if in doubt, don't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you think, yeah, maybe, just throw it out.
So smell, it's a very,
trust your own smell.
It is a very personal thing. And yes, you can learn to learn a lot about
right,
things.
By smelling more, by paying attention to your smell, you will develop it more.
And enjoy it. Enjoy it. Give us the name of the author and the
book. Once again, okay. It's Harold McGee. The book's called Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. And, you know, with the advent of the internet, I don't keep nearly as many research books around as I used to have to, because you can just look things up on the internet. But this book contains a lot of things that you would be hard put to find anywhere else.
It's fun.
It's a very thorough volume, and I'm really glad I bought it.
Nosedive. Good. And I've got a book here it's not quite as complete, but it's a fun read. What Einstein Told His Cook by Robert L. Wolke, W-O-L-K-E. And he's got a few things, not necessarily just about smell, but about food in general.
That book by Robert Wolke and also the Harold McGee book on food and cooking are two of the most well-known volumes on kind of the chemistry and the science in the kitchen. They're both really good science writers and in the way that's very useful.
It's nice to know those things. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So we've been talking about the sense of smell today, and we'll keep using that as we continue our adventures in the kitchen. Yes, we will. But let's end with a thought about trying new things. You know, like
trying new smells.
New smells. But social change, environmental change, political change. Too often, we turn up our noses at things that might challenge us, eh? No, we want to try new things because we can learn to change. We really can. Even here in Iowa, right in the middle of Iowa, you think we have it all figured out. Well, we're making some changes. Just recently, we decided to rename a creek that goes through Ames. The creek was called Squaw Creek. And to a lot of people, for many years, they said, hey, wait a minute here. Squaw Creek is not really one of your best names. I mean, maybe if all women were treated decently and all Native American women were treated decently, it would be fine. But it brings up a lot of sad memories and a lot of bad feelings.
Yeah, it might be considered derogatory.
Yeah, it might be.
Circles.
So it went through all the proper channels and people voted on it. And they went to the official state board of renaming creeks, I believe. And it has been passed. And I don't think Squaw Creek is going to be known as Squaw Creek anymore. They decided to call it Iowa Creek, which honors
after the Iowa Indians.
So there you go. And so we can learn new things. We can try to make changes.
Well, I'm glad we don't have to change the Skunk River.
I kind of like that.
I kind of like it too.
Here's a, in we're coming to the end of February, and this is a quote, sort of in the thoughts of Black History Month. Here's a quote from Martin Luther King about change. I thought I had a great thing about him.
We can't.
Here we go.
Okay.
The liabilities of history. One of the great liabilities of history is that all too many people fail to remain awake through periods of great social change. Every society has its protectors of the status quo and its fraternities of the indifferent, who are notorious for sleeping through revolutions. Today, our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, and to remain vigilant and to face the challenge of change.
Oh, right. We got to remember that one. The protectors of the status quo and its fraternities of the indifferent.
We don't know anybody like that. No. So try new things, smell new things. That's good. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you Tuesday live at noon. We repeat it at 7 p.m. on this fine radio station, KHOI, or anytime at KHOIFM.org. Support this fine radio station. If we're in your ears, put us in your heart. Hit the donate button. We had music today by Niall Vallely. He plays a fine concertina. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prezuntas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.